Policymakers oscillate between printing money, which causes inflation, and raising rates, which causes asset losses and/or a financial crisis. 40 years of this back and forth has resulted in almost $20 trillion in zero or negative yield government and corporate debt, the lowest interest rates in the last 5,000 years, and the most amount of global debt ever in human civilization. Today we hit Arthur Hayes's Pumping Iron. This is Bitcoin Audible. What is up, guys? We have got a great one today. Welcome back, and welcome to the significant influx of new listeners we've had in the past couple of weeks. It has been rather remarkable, to be honest. Thank you, and join us. We have a great time over here. Don't forget to subscribe, because I am putting out the best reads, guys' takes, and chats with some serious Bitcoiners all the time, near daily at this point. And I am your host, Guy Swan, the guy who's read more about Bitcoin than anyone else you know. Welcome to the show. Before we get into another amazing piece by Arthur Hayes, who also did Choose Your Fiction, which we read on the show, and this one is on the absolutely insane macro environment we find ourselves in, and I think is a good backdrop for the conversation we just recently had with Preston Pish. And this talks about how to position yourself to make it through to the other side of this thing. But real quick, let's talk about hardware wallets, the best way to hold your own keys. And our awesome sponsor, Shift Crypto, has a great little beast for you. Open source, very simple setup. And I have gotten this feedback from so many listeners now who agreed that they couldn't believe how clean the whole process was. And of course, it just looks good. The Bitbox O2 Bitcoin only, or multi-asset. I'm a big fan of the Bitcoin only, obviously. Bitbox O2, check them out at guyswan.com/bitbox. And the Bitbox is where you want to send your automatic withdrawals from your automatic Bitcoin savings account with swanbitcoin.com/guy. Don't trade. Don't fight the algorithms. Don't fuss about when to buy Bitcoin. Just auto stack whatever you can afford every week, month, or every day. Let Swan do it for you. Hassle free. Send it to your cold storage automatically. Set it once and it just runs. Check them both out at guyswan2ns.com. And with that, let's get into today's read. And it is titled Pumping Iron by Arthur Hayes. Disclaimer: any views expressed in the below are the personal views of the author and should not form the basis for making investment decisions, nor be construed as a recommendation or advice to engage in investment transactions. I used to be an amateur bodybuilder. Sometimes friends who haven't seen me since university remark at how skinny I am. Twice a day workouts and protein shakes were my life during university. Bonus points for anyone who can locate photos from the annual Mr. and Mrs. Pin competitions from 2005 to 2008. The photos used to be on the internet, but I can't find them anymore. The barbell investment strategy resonates uniquely with my past. It consists of constructing a portfolio comprised of beta to participate in the upside and volatility hedges that compensate and eclipse losses on the downside. This strategy is the simple output of Nassim Nicholas Taleb's musings about anti-fragility and engineering a life that exhibits positive convexity. Managing to find cheap convexity is quite difficult. You might happen upon it by chance, only to have your Vega disappear as time tiptoes forward. This is why entrusting a portion of your wealth to a skilled convexity fund manager is wise. I found such a fund, and the man in charge is a veteran OG trader. Every time I sit down for coffee with him, I feel like I'm getting bashed over the head with knowledge. I usually have to go home and brush up on my option Greeks to fully unpack the knowledge he dropped. Vana and Volga were the terms I recently Googled after I got home from our latest meeting. He is plugged into all the major dealing desks and sees structures that most retail and institutional investors will never witness. As he tells me, quote, "We buy what the banks are selling." The best part is, sell-side traders don't really care about the long-term implications of the options structures they price because of an annual bonus cycle. If the bank blows up years down the line because of flawed pricing, it doesn't matter, since they got paid cash money years prior. This allows savvy volatility funds to buy long-dated structures that are fundamentally mispriced. But everybody wins, so the dance continues. In this world of central bank largesse, all institutional money managers are grasping desperately for low-risk yield. Therefore, banks sell insurance and pension funds structured products with embedded options to enhance yield. The client is always selling volatility. The banks then have to recycle this, so they offload complex structures to sophisticated volatility funds. I routinely meet up with the fund manager to chat about his view on the markets. This sojourn to the financial fringes always leads to talking about the ways in which central bank policy is distorting the financial markets and society itself. He is steeped in our age's economic canon, as one of his university professors was the U.S. Treasury Secretary, Janet Yellen. He formally rejects most economic canon as poppycock, but his understanding of how the plumbing works allows him to purchase the right long-tail hedges. Let them eat cake. Quote, "In 2021, inflation is coming." This statement is now common knowledge. Everybody knows that everybody knows that inflation will rise this year and into the future. As such, what will the market decide is the asset that everybody should buy to protect their portfolios from the ravages of inflation? I came into the meeting with the fund manager determined to find the answer. After our hour-long conversation, it clicked when he said, "Arthur, you have the perfect barbell portfolio for this age. Long crypto, via my interest in 100X, and long interest rate volatility via my fund. I wish I had met you 5 years ago." We talked about Bitcoin for half the meeting. I asked him if he owned any, and he said no, but he tells all his clients they should own it. To him, it is the purest expression of inflation because it is the one asset class that central banks are not directly or indirectly managing through their policy mandate. The next few thousand words will unpack our conversation. And at the end of this essay, I hope you come away with the following. 1. The cryptocurrency complex, led by Bitcoin, is the best hedge against hyperinflation because it resides outside of the mainstream financial system. Even the best performing traditional asset will never eclipse the returns of the crypto complex during a period of inflation simply because all assets in the mainstream financial system are manipulated by central banks so that they do not output the correct inflationary warning signals. 2. If policymakers decide to try to avoid the endgame of hyperinflation, which has historically always been war and/or revolution, they will raise policy rates to push real interest rates into positive territory. That will crush asset values, including crypto. In this scenario, you want to be long government bond interest rates, usually via interest rate swaptions. Both scenarios are extreme, and the actions of global policymakers must be extreme due to the endogenous risk built up in the post-World War II Bretton Woods petrodollar financial system. There will be no muddle through. It's either or, and subsequently, a violent whipsaw between the two modalities. A Faustian bargain. Our government fiat petrodollar system began in 1971 when Tricky Dick, aka President Nixon, ended the Bretton Woods system by removing the USD convertibility with gold. Then US and Saudi Arabia agreed that if Saudi priced all oil in dollars, the American military would protect the monarchy. Other OPEC nations followed suit, such that oil could only be bought and sold with USD, forcing all other nations to convert to USD on a massive scale in order to participate in what was arguably the most important market in the world at the time. The petrodollar was born, allowing the US to retain its dominance as the world's global reserve without having to be pegged to gold. Unconstrained by the straitjacket of the gold standard, all currencies were suddenly floating against one another with no hard money anchor. All types of monetary folly became possible at a scale unprecedented in the history of human civilization. With a newfound ability to set short and long-term interest rates at the extremes, central bankers of the major economies embarked on a journey to artificially control business cycles. Every time the economy wobbled, the Fed and its peers cut rates. They never let the system completely reset by forcing losses on those who profited in the boom. The long OECD government bond has been one of the best risk-adjusted trades ever since the early 1980s. Just about every financial titan we worship today enacted a strategy that essentially levered up on long government bonds and rode them onto a 100-meter mega yacht. Risk parity is a prime example. Every time equity volatility spikes, I lever up on government bonds. You can call me Ray Dalio, and I'll see you at Burning Man at 10 and Esplanade. The 2019 Roots stage was lit. Thank you, Bridgewater. Latin debt crisis. Drop rates to save the Western banks from dodgy loans made to Central and South America. U.S. savings and loan crisis. Drop rates and guarantee bank deposits in SNL institutions that committed fraud, in some cases with how they managed company and depositor funds. Russian debt crisis and Asia debt crisis. Drop rates to save Western banks and hedge funds from dollar loans made to Russia and Southeast Asia. Subprime mortgage crisis. Drop rates to save the financial system from overinvestment in U.S. subprime mortgage credit. 2012 euro crisis. Drop rates to save a politically created union with a common currency but not a common government. Super Mario said he will do whatever it takes, and he meant it. Corzine was a bit too early in the trade. Sorry for your loss, MF Global Investors. 2013 taper tantrum. The Fed chairman Bernanke tried to take the punch bowl away via signaling that in the future the Fed would allow its balance sheet to naturally shrink as bonds matured. The lack of a constant flow of future wampum caused yields to spike, and the Fed subsequently walked back such inflammatory language. And COVID-19. Drop rates and monetize government deficits to fiscally support the economy, which governments shut down in an attempt to halt the spread of COVID. In many cases, these frequent financial crises were of themselves caused by central bankers raising rates to normalize or beat off uncomfortably high inflation or financial asset appreciation. Raising rates causes a crisis where the remedy is to drop rates lower than before. Therefore, while all of these crises were painful, they never drove any meaningful changes on how we approach the management of our economies, and the solution to each just sowed the seeds for the next financial flare-up. Policymakers oscillate between printing money, which causes inflation, and raising rates, which causes asset losses and/or a financial crisis. 40 years of this back and forth has resulted in almost $20 trillion in zero or negative yield government and corporate debt, the lowest interest rates in the last 5,000 years, and the most amount of global debt ever in human civilization. The inflation barbell. At one extreme, print money to lower rates so that debt can be repaid with debased money. This supports asset prices, which supports a high debt load. Those with financial assets benefit. At the other extreme, raise rates, which in turn depresses asset values, causing debtors to default and forcing them to hand their assets to creditors. These assets fall in value toward their fundamental ability to generate cash flow. Those earning wages benefit as their labor can buy more real and financial assets. Previously, policymakers could operate in the belly of the barbell. They didn't have to print excessive amounts of money, nor was the act of raising rates slightly so debilitating. However, the current situation does not afford our high clergy the luxury of being able to tweak around the edges. Consider this. In order to stave off the economic ravages of COVID and bring USD borrowing costs lower, the US Federal Reserve has injected approximately $3 trillion into the economy via quantitative easing. To fund this effort, it has expanded its fiscal deficit to levels not seen since World War I or World War II. And the big problem with using debt to stimulate the economy is you need ever-increasing amounts of it to generate the same level of output. It wouldn't be so bad if the world entered COVID with a low debt load, but heading into Q1 2020, global government debt to GDP was at its highest in human history. If the Fed were to raise rates at all, it would inflict staggering losses on bond portfolios worldwide. When real rates go from nothing to even 100 basis points higher, negative convexity destroys bondholders. That is why raising rates is the nuclear option. Instead, they go with the palatable, feel-good option, which is to continue piling on debt in the hopes that some transformational technological breakthrough allows productivity and output to accelerate so quickly as to expunge the crushing debt load. The stated policy goal of the Fed is to limit inflation to 2% annually. $1 loses half of its value after only 35 years of 2% annual inflation. For a young entrant into the workforce, 2% inflation means your savings need to return 50% just to stand still over your working life. That's not hard to do if a bank deposit or fiat government bond yields in excess of 2%, but they do not. You are now forced to speculate in the, quote, fair, free, and open financial markets. Cue everyone opening up their Robinhood, E-Trade, Schwab app. If this is considered good inflation, imagine how destructive even slightly higher levels are. When you buy a bond with a zero or negative yield to maturity, the only way you don't blow up is if central banks take rates even more negative. As I mentioned earlier, the end game of rampant inflation is always war and/or revolution. Show me a regime change and I will show you inflation. When you work your ass off only to stand still or get poorer, any ism that promises affordable food and shelter for the unwashed masses will reign supreme. If you are starving to death, nothing else matters except feeding your family. The symptoms of inflation are populism, social strife, food riots, high and rising financial asset prices, and income inequality. Policymakers know that if they engineer inflation that is too rapid, they will find themselves underneath the guillotine. So their only hope is to move back to the other side of the barbell, i.e. raising rates before bloodshed begins. Fighting inflation. Our masters at the Mariner Eccles Building told the world in no uncertain terms that they are willing for inflation to run, quote, hot, in order to, in their minds, rebuild the American economy. I focus exclusively on the Fed because every other central bank is subservient to them, since the Fed controls the global reserve currency. As a simple heuristic in this time of monetary inflation, did your portfolio appreciate at or above the increase in the broad money supply, M2? If not, you underperformed. US M2 expanded 25% in 2020. Take a hard look at your portfolio. Did you or the fee-charging flunky managing your money generate a return greater than 25%? With the threat of hyperinflation on the horizon, your job as a steward of your own and others' capital is very simple. Find a way to store financial wealth today that will allow you to outpace inflation and purchase energy tomorrow. Radigan Carter, a new favorite financial blogger of mine, wrote an excellent essay, Ample Liquidity and Productive Assets, which expounds on money's energy purchasing power. The first law of thermodynamics is not a suggestion. Energy is not created, nor is it destroyed. It only changes shape. Our entire civilization is built upon the use of dense sources of potential energy to create goods and services. We take this energy and we turn it into food, shelter, transportation, and entertainment. On a universal scale, all energy that ever was or will be is already in existence. As we move from potential stored to kinetic energy in action, there is exhaust. The lesser the waste, the more productive our civilization becomes. Burning wood is less efficient than burning hydrocarbons, which is less efficient than nuclear energy. As a steward of personal capital, we must save in financial terms in order to exchange for real goods. Saving real goods cannot be done at a personal level, and it is extremely risky. A thought experiment. It's 1900, and coal is the densest form of energy known for industrial applications. Coal powers all the amazing inventions of this current industrial revolution. You decide to take all of your savings and own coal directly. In the shed out back, you have a pit filled with coal, and now believe your energy needs are secure. In the future, you believe regardless of any monetary inflation, your coal holdings will allow you and your family to experience a constant quality of life vis-a-vis your energy consumption. Then oil is discovered in quantities that allow it to be used industrially. Coal's societal value declines. It's still useful, but it's way less efficient than oil. Therefore, its price versus financial assets declines. You are now actually poorer because while you are long a form of potential energy, you are short human technological innovation. It is suboptimal to attempt to pick a winner amongst physical potential stores of energy. Potential energy is also expensive and difficult to store in non-industrial quantities. It is better to accumulate a financial asset or monetary instrument that will stay constant or rise in its value versus the dominant form of potential energy. Gold has been, quote, money for almost the entirety of human civilization. And while the most important current exchange rate may be a financial asset or monetary instrument's value versus a barrel of oil, over the 10,000 years of human civilization, we have moved from animal to wood to coal to oil to nuclear and renewable forms of energy. Historically, saving in gold versus saving in physical raw energy is a safer bet. But that doesn't mean gold is necessarily the best bet. As investors, our goal is very simple, but difficult to achieve. Construct a portfolio of assets that will benefit disproportionately as global fiat liquidity, created by central bank money printing, washes into them. This is a common knowledge game. What does everyone else believe everyone else believes retains value? The degree to which an asset class captures the narrative is based on liquidity, scarcity, and transaction costs. Invest wisely, and you can maintain or increase your standard of life against the rising fiat cost of energy. Invest poorly, and the road to serfdom is real. You will find yourself working harder for a declining standard of living, and your fiat earnings and assets will not be able to keep up with the rising fiat cost of energy. Which asset? Let's do a quick tour around the major asset classes. I will evaluate them on liquidity, scarcity, and transaction costs. Stonks for the long run. I didn't have a high enough GPA to attend Jeremy Siegel's class at Wharton. However, his fame lives on in my memory. Liquidity, A-. Stocks are liquid. Each major economy has a domestic stock market, and the U.S. market can be accessed by most retail investors in some way. Scarcity, B. stocks are semi-scarce. While there is only one Tesla, Elon can and does routinely decide to increase the float and dump shares on the market as the stock price rises. This continuous dilution at the discretion of management presents a risk to investors. Transaction costs. A minus. Trading stocks is free, quote-unquote, in some cases, and in others carries low transaction costs. If the product is free, you are the product. That's neither good nor bad, just the truth. At a macro level, trading stocks is cheap, and will get cheaper with the explosion of digital finance. Verdict? B+. Stocks tick all the boxes, so the question then becomes which ones to buy. Every era has a sector that is hot. Being hot means that investors suspend fundamental cash flow analysis and buy into the story. Tesla is the epitome of this in our current era. Tesla is worth more than all other auto companies combined, even though it produces an extremely small fraction of global cars each year. It does not have positive unit cost economics on cars it produces when government subsidies are stripped away. A company that makes no money and depends on government largesse to continue its operation has made its founder one of the richest men in the world. This is a story stock. Investors believe in some future that is so amazing, it renders cash flow analysis moot. All stocks trade on a multiple to something the market cares about. Sometimes it's sales, cash flow, active users, etc. Each industry has its defining multiple that the market expects management to deliver on. Multiple expansion is when belief trumps reality. If my results are constant, but my stock price against those results increases, equity holders benefit. If my results are constant, but my value against those results decreases, equity holders suffer. Back to Tesla. If Tesla starts making money, but its multiple to EBITDA, or earnings before interest, taxes, depreciation, and amortization, declines, stockholders lose money. Therefore, as stocks or a sector switches from story-driven to being judged on their fundamental cash flows, multiples compress, and equity holders are punished. For the inflation-minded investor, this is suboptimal. You want to invest in one or a few assets that just go up based on liquidity, scarcity, and transaction cost terms. Worrying about the price-to-value metric is hard to do over a long period of time. You can entrust your money to successful stock pickers, but not everyone is deep value. The name of the game is beta to inflation. Why pay 2 and 20 for beta? Stocks are a very narrative-sensitive asset class, where the narrative is not constant across the entire universe of securities. I would put stocks as a top choice to hold value in a very inflationary environment, but buyer beware. Not all stocks can withstand the ravages of inflation. In fact, a recent piece by Charles Gave and Didier Darcet called Inflation and the Stock Market called into question the belief that any stocks perform well in inflationary environments. I haven't had a chance to fully digest this piece, but at first glance, the authors provide compelling statistics that point to the total amount of excess returns for the S&P 500 was driven by appreciation in disinflationary periods rather than inflationary or deflationary periods. I highlight to show that even my view that the broad index can perform well during inflationary periods might be erroneous. You can do better. Real estate never goes down. Every time I hear this, I cringe inside. But it is to be expected. Shelter is an essential human need. As long as there are humans, there will be a need for shelter. This is why, intrinsically, everyone gets why real estate holds value. Liquidity. A C. Real estate is not liquid. Buying a property in most jurisdictions takes between 1 to 3 months to close. Every property is different. There is no standardization or homogeneity outside of apartments in the same development. Therefore, everyone can't own the same type of unit, which destroys fungibility. Scarcity, A+. Real estate is scarce. They ain't making more land. This is especially true if you focus on urban areas. Zoning laws restrict what can be developed and how. This creates scarcity at a local level. Transaction costs, D. It is extremely expensive to trade real estate. Property agents in most markets earn percentage points of commission. Once you factor in taxes, commissions, and legal fees, it can cost 10 to 30% round trip to buy and sell a piece of property. We are trying to preserve wealth for energy consumption in the future, not pay economic rent to the government, lawyers, and agents. Verdict, C+. The good thing about real estate is that it has real cash flow. Either someone in theory could pay you rent, or you could use it yourself. The bad thing is that it is really hard to put a lot of money to work in real estate quickly. At the small investment scale, you don't get much diversification. If you can only afford to invest in one piece of property, you have to stomach a lot of local idiosyncratic risk endemic to its physical location that may or may not correlate to global liquidity conditions. Energy is priced on a global scale at the margin, not local. Fixed income. The problem with fixed income is in the name itself. Fixed. The returns are predetermined. What is not known is the level of inflation that should be used to discount future cash flows. A bond that trades at 50 with 100 par offers way more convexity than a bond that trades at 100 with 100 par. Liquidity. A+. Bonds are extremely liquid. Government bonds are the most liquid financial assets globally. They trade trillions of dollars per day. It is so easy to deploy capital into bonds, and that is why it is hard for large asset managers to stray too far away from some fixed income allocation. Scarcity. F. Bonds are not scarce. Well, highly positively yielding ones are scarce, but debt levels are at the highest level in history. The more debt a government or company issues, the harder it is to pay back that debt unless cash flows accelerate quickly. Transaction costs. B. Trading bonds is free or very expensive, depending on the issuer. If you are trading government bonds, the transaction costs are very low. If you are trading corporate bonds, the spreads are wide and markets opaque, just how the banks want it to be. Verdict, C. Bonds hate inflation, so owning them is suicide at this end of the barbell. All that glitters. All right, we're about halfway through. Let's take a quick break, hit the sponsor, and I gotta get something to drink, and we'll be right back. Seriously, are you still letting someone else hold your keys? Because that's not cool, yo. You gotta understand, that keeps you at a level zero Bitcoiner, colloquially known as the pores. That Bitcoin is just an IOU until you've got it on your BitBox. If this is a serious savings account that you want for the long term, you're holding Bitcoin to protect yourself and as a way to invest in the future. The easiest way to jump past level one and go straight to a level two, a true Bitcoin hodler, is the BitBox, a secure, personal, cold storage hardware wallet to hold your keys. The BitBox O2 is the ticket. Bonus points if you get the Bitcoin-only version. That's the one I got. I use it, and I have tons of other people tell me how seamless the setup process was. And the desktop app is super minimal, and yet it's very powerful. Check them out at my referral, guyswan.com/bitbox. Takes you straight to their site, and offer code GUY, G-U-Y, gets you 5% off. Plus, Shift Crypto has a bunch of other really cool tools for safe backups, tamper-proof bags, and other storage and things to check out on their store. Again, check them out at guyswan.com/bitbox. All that glitters. Now we move into the forms of money that may or may not stand the test of time. In my 2020 piece, Choose Your Fiction, available in audio at bitcoinaudible.com, I laid out my view of the three types of money. Fiction plus physical violence, government fiat. Fiction plus physical scarcity, gold, fiction plus digital scarcity, Bitcoin and cryptocurrencies. Debasing the domestic currency is the easiest option for a government that cannot deliver productivity and economic growth to its subjects. That is the implicit assumption throughout this essay. Therefore, I will not give a grade to any fiat currency. They all trade relative to each government's willingness and ability to debase its currency to achieve mercantilist outcomes. That is, namely, I want to devalue my currency so my export sector achieves global prominence. That way, my domestic industry is competitive, profitable, and hopefully, wages at the lower end are sufficient to engender the middle class to my form of government. We humans believe in the fiction of gold. It is shiny, beautiful when handled by skilled craftspeople, and holds its value versus the dominant form of energy. Full disclosure, I myself am a gold bug. I own the barbaric relic in the physical form and shares of gold miners. Liquidity. B. I have traveled to many cities worldwide, and there is always a section of a city where gold is traded. There is always someone willing to exchange something of value for gold. The problem with gold is that it is heavy. In small quantities, this weight is immaterial, but as you start to hold large quantities of gold, it becomes unwieldy to transport. It also attracts a lot of attention. How funny is it that we spend energy to dig it out of the ground, energy to lock it up safely, and energy to transport it to the market? The paper markets are quite liquid, but paper gold is just a trading vehicle. ETFs, futures, bank passbooks, etc. are gold derivatives. They are not the metal itself. If you really believe gold is money, you must own the physical. Every other trading product is some financial actor's liability. And if the system is inherently unstable, their promises will be found null and void in a time of crisis. Scarcity, A-. A geologist can give an approximate figure for the total amount of gold contained in the Earth's crust. We know how much is on Earth, but what about in the cosmos? At the rate space travel is being commercialized, it is not ridiculous to imagine a gold discovery on the moon or some stable asteroid in Earth's orbit. That would dramatically change the supply. Barring extraterrestrial discoveries, gold is sufficiently scarce to earn it a high grade. Many have tried to create the Philosopher's Stone. None have yet succeeded. Transaction costs. B. If you own a few coins, bars, or pieces of jewelry, it is quite expensive to buy and sell gold. You could pay up to 10% in terms of buy-sell spread to acquire and dispose of your gold. This is not ideal if the goal is to one day exchange gold for energy. In larger sizes, gold spreads are tight, but what will cost you is transport. Depending on where the gold comes from and goes to, it is not a trivial cost. That is the reason why central banks have historically stored their gold in one or more trusted money centers. London, New York, Shanghai, Hong Kong, and Singapore are some of the large trading hubs. Verdict. B+. Gold has history on its side. However, its physical weight is a drag on its usefulness. Rat poison squared. Warren Buffett is an excellent trader, so I won't hold his comments about Bitcoin against him. He is a pro at saying one thing but investing in another. Give him time, he will see the light. He used WMDs, also known as derivatives, adeptly when he bailed out Goldman Sachs in the 2008 Great Financial Crisis and took his pound of flesh in the form of warrants. Hypocrite is too harsh a term for such a smooth market operator. Bitcoin is fiction plus digital scarcity. The supply is fixed via open source code. With prominent hedge fund managers, corporate chieftains, and pension fund administrators beginning to dip their toes into the market, the narrative surrounding it has shifted massively. Find me a client willing to pay commissions to trade Bitcoin, and I will find you an investment bank with a Bitcoin buy rating. People think banks hate Bitcoin. No. They hate when a form of money or financial asset escapes their ability to rehypothecate it and or charge commissions to trade it. It is also likely not the existential threat to banks that some people think it is. The extinction level event for commercial banks is not Bitcoin or any other private digital asset. It is their domestic government allowing the populace to hold accounts directly with the central bank using a central bank digital currency, or CBDC. Stay tuned for my essay on this topic. Now that commercial banks' clients believe Bitcoin will protect their wealth from inflation, every major sell-side macro research analyst has a piece on it. Spoiler alert, they all think the price will appreciate markedly. Their arguments allow more beta-chasing institutional money managers to justify purchasing it. They likely aren't wrong, either. With bond yields at the zero bound, fixed income is the worst thing money managers can own. So they will have to rotate out of fixed income, where market-to-market losses are assured, into something else. This will be the most important source of flows and commissions this decade. Watch out for academic papers deriding the balanced 60-40 equity versus bond balance portfolio. That fixed income slice will get pushed lower, and that will unlock trillions of dollars of fiat that needs to find a home in one or more of the financial and monetary instruments described in this essay. And the last important fact about Bitcoin and the crypto ecosystem is that the vast majority of it is owned by individuals, not central or commercial banks. To my knowledge, no government treasury, central or commercial bank holds Bitcoin on its balance sheet. That means it cannot be sacrificed on the altar of credit, which subsumes an asset into the financial firmament in which we operate. Liquidity. B. Some friends of mine who work for major crypto OTC desks talk about the scarcity of physical. The largest net sellers right now are miners. Everyone else is hodling. This is the moment the ecosystem has been waiting for since 2017. Those who had to sell sold already. A good metric to monitor is the number of wallets from which nothing has moved in the last year and their percentage ownership of the total Bitcoin float. If that percentage is increasing, it means less supply is available for sale, and if it is falling, more supply is available for sale. Another similarly interesting metric reported by Glassnode is the amount of Bitcoin leaving exchanges, ostensibly to private wallets to be hodled. All of this hoarding is great for your mark-to-market fiat value. More fiat chasing a dwindling supply leads to pump city. But for those looking to put billions to work, it will be expensive. There is simply not enough supply at this market cap to accumulate the trillions that will be printed in the coming decade. Either you believe the price appreciation creates a positive feedback loop that encourages money managers to disregard the difficulty in putting on size and just YOLO, or you believe this will dissuade money managers from allocating a sufficient amount of capital, forcing them to continue acting as marginal buyers that push up the last traded price. Remember, it's about the flow, not the stock. The marginal buyer sets the last price, not those who bought before. I firmly believe liquidity will expand as interest in the space increases. While crypto on a macro level is the least liquid of the assets described in this essay, the market is 10 plus years old and billions of US dollars per day already trade across the various major exchanges and over the counter. Scarcity. A plus. There is no way to change the supply cap unless the network, which now spans millions of self-interested participants, decides amongst itself to alter it. The beauty of Bitcoin is that if you bought it for its 21 million supply cap, why would you vote to debase yourself? Could it happen? Technically. Would it be economic suicide for all participants in the ecosystem? Yep. Transaction costs. B+. At a retail level, trading Bitcoin is cheap, but still more expensive than trading stocks or government bonds. However, it more than compensates for the higher cost by removing the need for relying on intermediaries to move value. You simply pay the prevailing Satoshi per byte, and no matter the day, time, or year, you can transfer value from A to B. There are no centralized gatekeepers. Trading or transferring any of the items described above require the friendly assistance of banks, brokers, lawyers, and/or security guards. They don't dance no more. They make money move. As the OJs said, all the time they want to take your place. The backstabbers, backstabbers, they smiling in your face. All the time they want to take your place. The backstabbers, backstabbers. Verdict. A-. Bitcoin is the only monetary instrument that trades in a completely free market. Even if you nuke all the exchanges, Bitcoin can still be traded and transferred amongst global citizens. Its price is the market's true reflection of the inflationary nature of the policies enacted at this end of the inflation barbell. Rising rates. What happens if inflation gets too hot and central banks must raise rates to a territory where real interest rates are positive? Financial Armageddon. If it's so bad, why would they inflict pain upon wealthy financial asset holders? Because the alternative is that the rabble rise up and align themselves with a leader or system that will forcibly remove wealth from those who prospered in the ancient regime. Therefore, in the best interest of maintaining the social order, some losses must be inflicted upon those who hold financial assets. The Fed's stated goal is 2% inflation. Let's assume they achieve that, and they hold the 10-year bond at 1% interest. That means real rates are negative 1%. At that point, bondholders are essentially paying the government for the privilege of lending it money, which naturally, no one wants to do. One way to monitor current real rates, which are absolutely essential to charting out your investment strategy, is to compare government bond yields against nominal GDP growth. Currently, nominal USD government bond yields are rising, but if nominal GDP is growing at a pace greater than the interest rate of the 10-year bond, real rates are still negative. If nominal GDP growth is lower than the 10-year, real rates are positive. As of market open today, the U.S. 10-year Treasury yield is 1.47%, and given reflation expectations on the back of the COVID vaccine rollout, 2021 nominal GDP is expected to be well in excess of 1.5%, so real rates are currently negative. Turning back to our example scenario of 2% inflation and 1% 10-year bond yields, let's assume that the Fed recognizes the danger posed by negative real rates of negative 1% and freaks out, engineering the interest rate of 10-year bonds from 1% to 2% to match inflation and push real rates back to 0%. Now, let's evaluate what happens to the assets and forms of money described above following that rate hike. Stonks. I know fundamentals don't matter, but they do, eventually. The reason why investors can buy big tech, even with anemic or negative EBITDA, is because money is cheap. If you can crystallize gains in a story stock and then plow money into positively real-yielding government bonds, that's a slam dunk. The rotation out of growth into real-yielding fixed-income securities will be frenetic if the Fed ever raises real rates above zero. If you ever studied corporate finance or worked as an investment banking analyst, you should be able to build a discounted cash flow or DCF model. A stock should eventually pay a dividend, and therefore you can discount dividend payouts to the present and arrive at the value for a stock. In any DCF model, you forecast earnings out to a point, then you assume a terminal value. A short equation. Terminal free cash flow times parenthesis 1 plus the terminal free cash flow growth rate divided by the weighted average cost of capital minus the terminal free cash flow growth rate equals its terminal value. Now, this sounds like a lot, but it's basically an equation, a complicated sounding way of establishing that we need to compare expected future earnings against the cost of the capital it takes to make those earnings a reality. And as that changes over time, it changes the expected value of the company. All right, let's jump back in. Let's just look at the terminal value of a stock that has $100 of earnings that will grow at 2% per year forever, with a WACC, or weighted average cost of capital, of 5%. It comes out to $3,400. Remember that a company's WACC, or cost of capital, is a calculation of its cost of capital across all of its sources of capital, including debt, which has its interest rate dictated by the interest rate of government bonds. So if this company's WACC was 5% prior to the Fed's 1% rate hike, it is now 6%. Let's see what happens to the terminal value of a stock. It's now $2,550. The stock that was worth $3,400 is now worth $2,550, a 25% drop caused by just a 1% rise in the cost of capital. That is negative convexity, as the stock price fell faster than the rise in the WACC. Bad news bears. And it gets worse. If the WACC started at a lower level, meaning the spread to growth was tighter, your initial value is higher, but your percent losses are greater. Let's plug in an initial 3% WACC to the same stock. Before the 1% rate hike, it's $10,200. After the 1% rate hike, it's $5,100. At a 3% cost of capital, the terminal stock price is $10,200, and at a 4%, driven by the rate hike, the stock price falls to $5,100. Stock price negative 50%. WACC plus 1. Whoa! Such returns! You deserve that 2% management fee. If you buy an asset where funding costs are already depressed, the negative convexity that results from a modest 1% rate hike is massive. Buying overvalued stocks because of a depressed discount rate is great as long as more liquidity follows your purchase to keep the price high and rising. That will persist as long as rates are low. But if interest rates rise even modestly, your losses will be magnificent. Real estate. The biggest real estate sector is residential. Most people buy their home with government or bank-provided leverage. The U.S. has the largest mortgage market in the world. Let's look at a standard 30-year fixed-rate amortizing mortgage. You have a constant payment that over the next 30 years will pay off the principal plus interest. I will not go into the math, but if you use the amortization functions on Excel, you can replicate my figures. The price a person can pay for a house depends on the affordability of the mortgage payment. Assume the median family can afford to pay $422 per month on a mortgage. Assume they take out a 30-year mortgage with monthly payments at a fixed interest rate of 3%. That means they can afford to buy a $100,000 house. Now the rate rises to 4%. The median family can still afford to pay $422 per month, but the rate increase means they can only afford to buy a house worth $88,309. The rate rose 1%, and now they can afford a 12% less house. Given that the notional value of property is so large relative to wages, real estate is very sensitive to financing. If an asset cannot be financed, the price of the asset must be lowered so that the monthly payment is affordable. In the simple market illustrated above, the price of the median house must fall 12% in unlevered terms so that the median family can still afford it. Given that most deals are done with some sort of financing, levered losses on real estate portfolios will be substantial should interest rates rise. Fixed income. As with most things in life, bond returns are path dependent. If you buy a bond in a low rate regime, where we currently find ourselves, your losses will be exponentially greater for any small move higher in interest rates. This is why any asset manager with a fixed income allocation expresses night tremors. The mandate says take new capital and purchase currently low-yielding bonds. If rates rise, they are doomed. Allow me to illustrate. Keeping it simple, let's value the fair price of a 10-year bond issued before the rate hike. The face value of the bond is $1,000. The coupon is 2% per annum, and the risk-free rate is 1%. The present value as a percentage of face value is 109.47%. The Fed raises the rate by 1 to 2%. Now this 10-year bond's price drops to 100%. Rates rose by 1%, but the bond price dropped by almost 10%. Negative convexity strikes again. Let's use the same numbers, but instead, the starting discount rate is 5%, and rates rise 1% to 6%. The bond price drops from 76.83 to 70.56 for a loss of approximately 6.3% for a 1% rise in interest rates. The convexity is still negative, but less so. As I said earlier, large asset managers with a large fixed income allocation will take profit after a 40-year bull market and deploy those trillions of fiat dollars, pounds, euros, francs, etc. into equities, real estate, precious metals, crypto, or anything else the establishment believes performs well in an inflationary environment. The math couldn't illustrate the ruin of fixed income investing at the zero bound of risk-free rates any more clearly. Gold. Gold has no income, is the common refrain from haters. And while it's true, the price of gold also tracks nicely against the ebb and flow of real rates of the global reserve currency. Simply put, gold is a good hedge when real rates are negative. But when they turn positive, gold gets the stick. If I can easily earn a positive real return on my fiat, I don't need to save in gold. My income from investing in low-risk, positively yielding fixed income assets covers the rising fiat cost of energy. The last mega gold bubble was during the 1970s stagflationary period where the cost of energy, oil, in real terms, skyrocketed. Fed Chairman Volcker came in with the inflation hammer and raised short-term rates well above 10% to depress inflation expectations. Gold subsequently crashed and is still below its inflation-adjusted peak in the late 1970s. Bitcoin. The value of Bitcoin is digital hard money that rides on its own transmission network. It has value both from fiat liquidity escaping inflation and the market's imputed value of the non-aligned decentralized payments and communications network. Bitcoin's value equals liquidity preference plus perceived technological value. I do not have a model for an estimate of the ratio between the two, but at a high level, if global fiat liquidity can earn a real return again in government bonds, it will exit Bitcoin and crypto. The whole point of this exercise is to preserve or grow purchasing power against energy. If that can be done in the most liquid asset, government bonds, then liquidity will take the easy option. The amount of remaining technological value is beyond my skills to estimate. However, it is much lower than the current fiat price of Bitcoin today. Go long interest rates. It sounds so easy, but it is so difficult. As outlined above, the majority of financial and monetary instruments respond positively to falling interest rates, not rising ones. Who is a price-insensitive seller of interest rate volatility? By law, many supranational pension and insurance funds must invest in fixed income. The yields are low, so the funds sell interest rate options to banks to enhance the yield. The banks then turn around and sell these options to sophisticated volatility funds. Because the distortions in the interest rate markets are so large, since every central bank's stated policy is yield compression in the search for inflation, these interest rate options, swaptions, trade extremely cheaply. The PM told me about a large bond deal that was sold entirely to Taiwanese insurance companies. The embedded Bermudan options allowed him to buy 1 year by 30-year swaptions for a basis point on $100 million of USD notional. A few percentage points rise in rates yields several million-dollar payouts. Ship them in. Also, the value at risk models are based on a flawed Gaussian normal distribution, which underestimates the tails and thus underprices risk. Therefore, if you can stomach small, consistent losses, massive payouts are possible when the system adjusts to a rising rate environment. Again, this is Taleb 101. All his books are a must read. Great. Conceptually, it makes sense. However, as a retail or even high net worth individual, you cannot buy these exotic options. I have an ISDA with a major dealer. I get face ripped on OTC options. However, there are many instances where the bank will refuse to show me a price even if I'm willing to cross the spread. This is why, if you are able to invest in volatility funds that explicitly invest in tail risks, do it. It solves neatly for this side of the inflation barbell. If you can't, options on Eurodollar interest rate futures or put options on government bond ETFs might be another way to benefit hugely if or when policymakers decide to raise rates. It's really quite simple. The imbalances inherent in the post-World War II USD Bretton Woods and petrodollar regime can only be fixed at the extremes. The easy option is to keep real rates negative and inflate the debt away. But for how long can this be done before those who do not hold enough financial assets revolt in the face of high and rising energy costs? If the societal discount crescendos to an unbearable level, policymakers must change course. That change will be to raise rates so that real rates are positive. Given the market believes that central bankers have solved the business cycle, a rate hike will be cataclysmic in terms of losses across the financial system. Is it better to have your head on your shoulders or another 1,000 points higher on the S&P 500? Build a portfolio of long crypto plus long interest rate volatility. Walk away and watch the fireworks. And again, this one was by Arthur Hayes from BitMEX. And as I put in a little aside as we read through it, the Choose Your Fiction article that he wrote some time ago is also available at bitcoinaudible.com. Search in the library. It's there. I'll have it in the show notes as well. Should be relelatively easy to find. One of the takeaways from this piece it's great and he details it really well in this piece, but just that people do not understand is how unique our financial situation is in history. He's got a line, in fact, it'll be the one that I put at the beginning of this episode probably, says 40 years of this back and forth talking about lowering rates, trying to ease them just a little bit to slow down inflation, and then the subsequent lowering of rates and pumping in of more debt in order to prop up and continue the thing to flatten out these business cycles and give the perception of all of this growth. So that's the 40 years. The 40 years of this back and forth has resulted in almost $20 trillion in zero or negative yield government and corporate debt, the lowest interest rates in the last 5,000 years, and the most amount of global debt ever in human civilization. Trying to figure out how all of this unravels is, like he says, hedge and watch the fireworks. Because we have a horrible monetary foundation. And basically the only option is one horrific extreme or another horrific extreme. And as he says, hyperinflation. Hyperinflation means death of a country. It means revolution. It means war, period. That's how it goes. I don't think there's a single one in history that, or at least that I can think of. And, he says in this piece, you show me terrible inflation or hyperinflation, I'll show you war and a revolution. And it's obviously perfectly clear that populism, social unrest, that was the other thing. In fact, I actually tweeted that out earlier today, was Where is it? The symptoms of inflation are populism, social strife, food riots, high and rising financial asset prices, and income inequality. I mean, really, aside from the food riots, that's what better way to describe the last couple of years of this country? Hell, last decade or two. We don't have easy times ahead. But again, some of the very interesting things that could unfold in this transition. And I find it interesting, really, the two positions basically here, right? Long Bitcoin or crypto and long the volatility of interest rates. And it's very easy to see back in 2019 before the crisis hit and it was clear that the financial markets are already basically cracking and were about to explode back in this, just after the summer, I think it was actually like September of that year, overnight rates jumped from like 1% to 10%. There was just a huge liquidity crisis and the Fed had to dump $200 billion or something like that into the market in a matter of hours just to suppress those interest rates. Because, I mean, like he said, I mean, he details out, and this is a perfect way to show the exaggerated losses that come from basically goods and markets like equities and things that simply thrive because the interest rate is low. And the lower the interest rate is, the more they are benefiting from a discounted rate, like 1%, you know, loans or something like that, that is making the cost of capital for somebody like Tesla or Uber or Amazon, some company that doesn't even may not even make profit at all, really, or has incredibly minimal profit. The fact that they have that incredibly low cost of capital is what makes them, which is what boosts their value so greatly. And the more they are benefiting from that discount cost, the greater their valuation is hit. And he has this like simple model that I'm sure sounds obnoxious in audio, but the simple idea is just that if you account for the difference in their growth rate versus the difference in their future cost of capital, take those rates into account and you have huge swings on the low end, like a difference between 10% and 11% cost of capital isn't very big. It might be 2 to 3% or something like that of the stock valuation. But when you're talking about going down to 0% or 1% rates for accessing capital and then bumping that up 1%, you're talking about huge, huge differences in the premium on these companies. I mean, when he says the stock markets would implode, like he's not wrong. Like they would literally implode. Like it would be financial Armageddon. That is literally the mechanism by which the entire prices of all of these things have been propped up. I mean, just look at the crash that happened back in March of 2020, March of last year, and subsequently with Bitcoin, right? Same thing happened with Bitcoin because of the demand, the need for basically liquidity in very, very short order to not get completely wiped out. But everything took a massive hit with just, you know, minor shifts in the interest. Well, minor, but you get the idea. Like the fact that we are sitting that fragile in the financial markets, so many things could take a hit. That's kind of the beauty of Bitcoin and I guess crypto in a sense, just the nature of the beast is that this thing is held entirely outside of the financial markets. But this is why when I was talking with Preston, this is why even that potential risk of if interest rates rise substantially so that they basically cut their own foot off to save their face, just to stop inflation and to stop what would potentially be a revolution in the country or across the modern world, really, even if they do that, I think short term would hit any speculative asset, anything that is seen as a hedge against the garbage yield that is across the financial space and across bonds, I can't help but wonder. I'm very, very curious how it plays out if Bitcoin can establish real interest rates. Because that's kind of the beauty of it, is that Bitcoin is a free market. Its rates are real. It's not stuck within some paper credit market or a liability of some large institution that's controlling the trading. It's free flowing on its own transmission network. And in doing so, and it's global, obviously, there's markets everywhere. So arbitrage between any potential credit market or paper market that does attempt to manipulate Bitcoin, arbitraging across that to a market in Bitcoin in Taiwan or Russia or South America somewhere that is legitimate and does have the proper rates, becomes incredibly valuable. And it really screws up the ability even for big players to start manipulating the market. They eventually get outpaced by the fact that this is global and all they can do is influence a single jurisdiction. And that's even if they manage to do it at all, when it's an asset that explicitly people are holding themselves. As he points out in this, is that the vast majority of those holding and working and are buying in Bitcoin and having it on their quote unquote, you know, reserves are individuals. It's not governments, banks, or central banks, the very people who are used to pulling all the reins. But remember, Bitcoin is a basis for a new financial system. It has its own derivatives. It has its own market. It will build its own quote unquote risk-free rates. The Lightning Network is a payment network that pays returns in Bitcoin. The establishment of its own, basically, financial language, in a sense, it will allocate better than whatever the government or central bank does in trying to correct the disaster that they have caused. Bitcoin will be the more efficient allocator because it is a market allocator where they are a central allocator. It's a very simple assessment of real prices versus price controls. Real prices are going to do better, period. And on the context of a technological value, I don't really know. That feels like an improper terminology, maybe. You know, what would you say the technological value of TCP/IP is? Like, if you were just looking at, what does that mean, right? It's the value of an open permissionless communications network. This is an open permissionless monetary network. Everything that can't be built or isn't allowed or doesn't have the regulatory framework or can't be done unless it's custodial or can't be done globally or can't be done because the cost of just being an authority in the legacy financial system is too expensive for it to even be economically viable. All of those things will be built on Bitcoin. So I don't know if you call that technological value, but Bitcoin isn't simply an asset. It is a network and a communication language. So while any short-term volatility in interest rates, I think, can absolutely cause excessive volatility and depress the price of Bitcoin and the whole ecosystem as a whole, I don't think there's a long-term bear case for Bitcoin that isn't SHA-256 gets broken, really. If it simply continues to be an open permissionless network with a secure monetary policy, I really don't think there's a solid bear case. The best would probably be excessive attempts at austerity and extremely strict fiscal conservativeness from governments and central banks, basically across the modern world, allowing the entire stonk system to completely explode, allowing housing market to completely implode, obviously under the presupposition that we are preventing a revolution from happening. This is essentially their only mechanism at this point to retain the status quo power structure. But even then, you're looking at systemic risk everywhere. Maybe you're holding a derivative that benefits from volatility, but is your institution going to be there to fulfill that bill? Whose liability is it? Are they liquid? Are they solvent? Is your government? And to talk about it in the context that they're going to let interest rates rise, how the hell are they going to afford it without inflation? They're going to pay their own interest. They're going to use the entire tax revenue of the government just to pay interest and offer no services whatsoever. Again, we're in a situation where we have the largest amount of global debt ever in human civilization. Is the United States government just going to default? Or are they going to inflate their debt away? I don't know. It's crazy. It's absolutely crazy. And people just don't realize, like, the mainstream just has no idea that we're all sitting with our, you know, dangling our legs off the edge of the Grand Canyon here. And the government is legitimately talking about coming by just pushing everybody off. And we're over here, like, taking selfies and pretending like everything's okay. I don't want to be anywhere near that. Even in the context of, I mean, he's absolutely right in the context of long volatility, long interest rate volatility. Because volatility, interest rates, if they move at all, they're going to move big. And they're going to move very fast. I mean, we saw the, 0.8? It's like 80 basis points rise. I think that's right. It's somewhere around there. But it was a pretty quick rise in just a matter of a few days very recently. We're talking about just a couple of weeks ago. And this has huge effect. The macro voices, I think it was macro voices. I don't know. I saved a thing of it in my notes to get back to and listen to. But it was an episode of a macro financial podcast of some sort, talking about how a 50 basis points increase was the entire cost of, like, the U.S. Navy and the U.S. Marines just in interest rates or payments, interest payments for government debt. So, yeah, interest rates could increase, but how does the government afford it? How does the government pay any of it? And when there are real interest rates developing and multi-trillion dollar markets developing in an open, global, near frictionless financial system that will continue to grow and build all sorts of novel applications that can't be built in any other context, non-custodially, for that matter. I don't know. It'll be the pace of development. It'll be the pace of the infrastructure build out. And those things are critical. And it will also be Bitcoin defining its own interest, its own cost of capital over time, which, again, like I said numerous times very recently, I think this is the most absolutely bullish and fundamentally important things that the Bitcoin space can do. And in doing that and having strong futures and derivatives markets, you can start writing secure long-term contracts Bitcoin denominated. You can basically hedge against significant price volatility or purchasing power volatility in Bitcoin, and it makes a circular closed economy, a section of the Bitcoin ecosystem that never leaves Bitcoin, far more likely, far easier. And as that friction drops, it will grow. It will grow at an incredible pace. So we'll see. This was a really interesting piece, though. I love the way everything was framed and giving everything a grade. And, you know, just a couple of years ago, you never would have thought that serious hedge funds and large capital managers and anything would ever have put Bitcoin up against this framing, right? Sitting it legitimately next to gold, real estate, government bonds, all of these things. And I think this is just the beginning of Bitcoin coming into this space, and the sheer just short-term growth potential in realizing that everyone should be treating it this way is massive. And when it truly enters that space and truly has the infrastructure to handle that level of market movement and that level of capital, it's perfect scarcity and amazing utility as a monetary network only increases that feedback loop to make it orders of magnitude more valuable. The way that I think about, because he says in this piece actually, is that if you can have a higher yield with government bonds, with today's reserve currency, which is government bonds, then why would you be speculating on Bitcoin or crypto? But I see as something more fundamental has shifted with the existence of Bitcoin. And in the long term, this will be the predominant shift, the predominant narrative, the predominant fiction, whatever you want to call it, that makes Bitcoin the replacement for government bonds as the world reserve currency. Gold was a bearer asset that did not work well in a virtual environment, but works great as a monetary good and in a strictly physical environment. When markets were physical, when markets were always in person to some degree, gold was by far the best money because it had the best monetary attributes and the best scarcity. When we moved to a virtual economy, gold simply became a liability. In fact, all of our assets, because of the digital environment and the natural centralization of all digital goods and finance in the digital space, even the quote-unquote decentralized goods, even the bearer assets like gold, simply became a promise. He says in this piece, paper gold, futures, ETFs, all of these things are just promises. Money switched from being a bearer asset that had value in its own right to debts, to credit. And in that context, if money became credit, no matter what you used, whether you used gold and silver or real estate or whatever it is, who's got the best credit? What's the most trusted credit instrument? What is seen as the basis of that civilization, the basis of that society? The governments. The one that can always steal from its people to fulfill that debt. Because we were in a virtual environment, all money, even things or goods with real value, stocks, equities, all of it, became a debt, became someone else's liability. Therefore, the most reliable promise becomes the most reliable money, the global reserve currency in this context. And what was it after World War II? U.S. dollars, the United States liability. And in a general sense, it's not really changed from that. Even when it was backed by gold, it was their liability to fulfill something physical. And now it's just a liability to fulfill a cost, to fulfill the citizens of the United States to pay it back and the productivity of the U.S. economy. Their liability is that it will do well and therefore they can drain it of resources to pay back the value of those bonds. But something fundamental has changed with Bitcoin. Because Bitcoin is both virtual and a bearer asset. It's nobody's liability. We're in an environment where a liability doesn't have to be money anymore. It was only that way because a virtual paper environment made it necessarily so. So since everything was credit, the best credit was the best money. But now we have a digital bearer asset. We don't have to have credit anymore as our money. And even better, the asset itself is programmable. So we can have a liability that's backed up by actual signatures and is non-custodially allocated to somebody. A lightning channel is essentially my promise to have liquidity to someone else. But they don't have to trust me not to take their funds, and I don't have to trust them in order to offer it up. Bitcoin settles that agreement per the contract with no custodian. It is a financial service without a financial service provider. And I just think this is the beginning. This is the first thing we figured out we can do with TCP/IP, right? I think we fundamentally changed the nature of money. And on a short-term time frame, you know, 5 to 10 years, these things are all incredibly important. What we read in this article, I think, is still spot on, and this is the most important. These are some of the biggest fundamentals and macro things to be concerned about and consider when you're looking at our situation and when you look at monetary history. This is a big, big thing that we are going through. But I think Bitcoin is equally, is near equal in the shift that's happening. Bitcoin isn't just another gold that costs less to move around. And I think that should be taken into account. Regardless, liquidity crisis, interest rate spike, whatever it is, this is all Bitcoin for me. I don't even want to touch the legacy system or be at risk to any systemic problems that that thing might have. Derivatives that require some institution or bank to pay out. I hope somebody else can find a way to feel like they're safe in that environment, but it scares the living crap out of me. So anyway, just a really interesting perspective. I loved this piece. Arthur Hayes does such a good job with writing these up, and I'm very curious. He said there was going to be another article about, what was it? Crap, I don't remember. But I'm gonna read it. I don't know what it is. I forgot. I feel like the topic was really interesting when I was reading through this piece, and I was like, oh, that's gonna be cool. But I've completely forgotten it. So there's that. All right, don't forget to follow BitMEX and BitMEX Research, which is just their blog and some of the things they write up and the data they have available is just really amazing. This is a great, great resource that I've had. They also just recently wrote The Block Size Wars, which I have not gotten to yet, but I am super, super excited about because it's one of the most fascinating and interesting historical times in Bitcoin that we've had. And I think it's super critical that people understand how that unfolded and the major reasons why. So with that, let me go ahead and close this one out. I even said I wasn't going to do a guy's take this time, but look how well that worked out. real quick, I want to get to today's Bitcoin resource. And before we do, a huge thank you. I've gotten a handful, quite a few new patrons to this show. Thank you so much for donating. It really means so much to me that you guys just want to support my work and jump into the Telegram and hang out with the rest of the Audionauts. So thank you all who've recently joined and everybody who's stuck with me through years of this show at this point. And a huge thank you to Swan Bitcoin for the no-nonsense automatic savings account at swanbitcoin.com. Bitcoin savings account, excuse me. swanbitcoin.com/guy for some free sats when you open up your account. And then, of course, your safe, open source, sleek and just good looking, easy to use hardware wallet, the Bitbox O2 from Shift Crypto. Don't buy from a real retailer. Don't buy that mess on Amazon. Get it straight from Shift Crypto. Or you can use my link, guyswan.com/bitbox. All my stuff is right there on my website at guyswan.com. Okay, so today's resource, and I've only just signed up and gotten on this thing, but I've had a number of people tell me that it's worked and it's awesome, and I'm so excited to start using it. So I'm just going to go ahead and throw it out there. Paywithmoon.com. It is a way to create a virtual Visa card that you can just create on the fly. You pay Lightning Network. You pay with Lightning Network to create this thing, and you can just do it for any amount you possibly want. So I could just create a card. I could go up on Amazon for, you know, put a bunch of stuff in my cart for $73.47. And I can create a Pay with Moon Visa card for $73.47, and then use those card details at the checkout and be done. You know, I was excited, really excited about the service when I first heard about it, and Strike was actually offering 5% back to use Pay with Moon. I'm not even sure if they're still doing that, but I didn't get immediately to be able to jump on it. I was just kind of like, oh, that's really cool. And then I've had enough people tell me that they've used it and it worked and that it's awesome, that just today I was like, all right, I gotta break down and do this. But I haven't used it yet because, I stack sats, you know, I try not to spend them if I can avoid it. I might be spending it on some Amazon or something here a little bit tonight. And I might use Strikes that I'm just using from my bank account. But anyway, paywithmoon.com, definitely one to check out. All right, guys, thank you so much for listening to Bitcoin Audible. I will catch you next time. We have got many, many, many more great reads and episodes and a couple of really, really awesome conversations that I think are coming very soon. So stay tuned, subscribe, and until next time, everybody, take it easy. This has been a 111 production, and you were listening to Bitcoin Audible on the Crypto Economy Network.
This podcast is a part of the C-Suite Radio Network. For more top business podcasts, visit c-suiteradio.com.